Hello, Lucy. I am a best girl friend, Anthony, from Nigeria. And first of all, I want to give a really deep shout out to you for all the work you put into your podcast. And it really inspires me. And I can really bet my bottom dollars that it inspires a lot of your listeners out there, a lot of people who just hit on it and listen to it. So thank you so much, Vusi, for being a blessing to the world in your own way. Fast forward, I've listened to your podcast, and from my experience, I'm going to say it should be a binging podcast. It should be an ever-binging podcast. It should be literally everywhere I'm in. You all should listen to this podcast because it's so going to uplift. You're going to learn a whole lot and you're going to implement everything you've learned. I've listened to lots of your episodes on growth, on imposter syndrome and how to tackle debt, you know, and all of those really, really amazing ones. And so far, I have been implementing them mentally, psychologically, and then physically to seeing the best result of it. And yes, I can attest that it is working. It is real. It is valid.
Hey, VT, this is Shaheen. I am from Durban in KwaZulu-Natal. I just wanted to reach out and say, you know what, thank you so much for what you put into the world. The podcasts I recently started listening to, I have been following you on your socials for quite a long time. I have watched your videos. Your videos usually pop up on my feed, and I do pay attention to what it is that you are saying, the things that you do, you know, the type of person that you are. And recently, you know, there are always struggles that come up when it comes to business, when it comes to studying, you know, there's always trials and tribulations that come up. But recently I started listening to your podcasts, and specifically the one with Lamar Tyler that you had. I listened to it recently and it took me to where I wanted to be. I started thinking a bit more outside the box. I started doing things a little better, a little differently, and you know, things seem to be working out. So I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for what you're putting into the world. And you know, if you do get a chance to listen to this, I really hope that you know, you keep doing what you're doing and more people get to hear what it is that you're saying.
It's time to take your seat at the table. Find out how with Vusi Tembegwayo as we discuss ideas that matter. A catalyst for bold action.
Hello, family. In today's episode of Ideas That Matter, I interview the indelible John Su, the former CEO of LegalZoom, a platform which, whilst he didn't found, he joined and scaled as CEO, listed on the NASDAQ, and exited in 2021 at a valuation of $7.5 billion. John is one of the few people I know who've gone from operator to scaler, and today to investor at large ticket sizes into very, very disruptive tech across the world. Today, John runs a family office, and he has a very interesting view about the future of AI, the future of tech, the future of capital, and what you and I can learn as entrepreneurs about how to position ourselves for this very prescient moment. This is Ideas That Matter. Enjoy. So help me understand this, right? So if I'm an external person watching this conversation, the difference between kind of the banking world of providing capital versus the world you and I live in, admittedly, you're in a very different space in the FO space, but just like high level, like what are the main differences? And then we'll dig a bit deeper into
main differences between
how the capital is deployed and what the founders and entrepreneurs receiving that capital would experience.
By level of stage. Okay, yeah, so sure. I'd say I spent a good part of my career in the early stage tech, co-founding, raising, you know, $5, $10, $15 million in the, you know, to get stuff going. Mm. And then as some of the companies were getting larger and requiring more capital, then I started raising more $50, $100 million, $500 million rounds of capital.
Sure.
The biggest difference is it's all data. You know, in the early rounds, it's like the Angel A's, it's been a while since I did those, but
yeah.
You know, that's all personality.
Right.
That's all people. They don't care what the PowerPoint says. They don't care what the BS financials hockey stick. Because like, let me see, it just goes up and to the right. Right? and it's got how many digits at the end of it. You think you're going to do $2 billion in 5 years? You know, it's like, so you will be the third highest grossing revenue startup in history.
Yeah.
You know, and I got 12 of those in just this batch for this pitch contest. So, you know, they don't care, but they say, but you, what I see is you're going to get up. Mm. You're going to get thrown hooks to the head, body punches, solar plexus, kicked in the knees. Mm. You're going to get back up. Mm. That's what I see. Mm. And you're going to think your way through it. I don't care what your original business plan is. 3 years from now, it'll be a different business plan from what you learn. I'm betting you're going to adapt, deploy capital efficiently, and have a decent chance of getting me to an exit. So I'm betting on the team.
Nice.
And I like your top three people.
Nice.
Right? So that's the early stage. People, people, people. When you're getting a nine-digit check.
Yes.
And I was helping out a PE. PE reached out to me and said, hey, we're looking for like an operator vetter. Hmm. I was like, what does that mean?
What is that?
I was like, well, I'm looking at making acquisitions and we're deploying, you know, $500 million to $1 billion in an acquisition, you know, levered. And we want someone that can vet it as an operator that says, what do you see that we can't see? Because we didn't run this type of business.
Right,
before.
Like an operational DD.
Yeah, so we want you to go deep on diligence.
Got you.
And late stage, it's all data. You can hide nowhere. So it's not as big a pitch. In some ways, late stage, now, I think the really good ones care about the team.
Sure.
Quite a bit because they want to make sure you can execute. But they're also saying, well, if you're not, I'm just going to switch you out anyways. So they're looking at the data and the asset being the company. And they don't put a lot of, some people say they do, but the reality is human capital is more fungible to them at that late stage. Mm. They're not founder driven. They don't like founders. Mm. The first thing they see a founder is, I want to switch that founder out
right.
to someone that can run it at scale.
Right.
I'm like, so you would have switched out Bezos, you would have switched out Elon Musk.
Sure.
He's like, yeah, I would have missed him and switched him out. Occasionally we let them go through, but generally it's not a good bet for us.
Why is that?
Well, I think one example of this, and then I'll get back to that later. Well, let me finish this and then I'll go to that question. So when I was helping out this PE, I said, well, walk me through it. And I go, well, we're going to spend $5 or $6 million in diligence on this acquisition. Hmm. And the odds are 80%, 90%, we're going to walk away from it. Hmm. I go, so you're going to, how many times do you spend $5 or $6 million in diligence and walk away? It says more often than we write the check.
That's crazy.
So I go, so they have a team of accountants, they have a team of engineers, they've got a team at HR, they got a legal team, and then each one is going through super detailed. They got a subscription, they got a pricing team. So all these teams are coming back with all of this data. They're pouring through the data room, they're going through everything, they're doing crazy background checks, they're going super deep. And I said, and now we need an operator to go in there and say, okay, as an operator, what perspective can you give to us as a third party? And if we conclude the transaction, we'll put you on the board, you'll take an equity seat, that kind of thing. And so when I looked at that level of diligence, they don't care if you're a good pitch, they're like, we don't care about your pitch. We're going to spend thousands of hours cumulatively on just diligencing. Mm. So, yeah, the initial pitch, you know, it puts you in the scope of something, but they're going to go super deep. So that's where it's all data. Mm. It's all intensity and human capital. You know, the whole part of a lot of the early stage growth stage companies, the IVPs and the Kleiners, like, I want founder-driven companies.
That's right.
I want to stay with this founder. I want to do a second company, a third company, or a fourth company, whatever it may be. We're going to stay with you for life and you know, and it's a badge of honor that you stayed with me instead of with them.
That's right.
You know, my friends on
the
other side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
We co-invest
yeah.
stuff, but you stayed with me instead.
Yeah.
So it's a different world. Late stage are like, we like you. I know we went to college together and all that stuff, but I'll probably switch you out. You know, we do that.
And completely non-emotional.
Totally non-emotional. I mean, some of these, like, you know, Vista, that's their playbook. If you sell to them, you understand the vast majority of time they're going to switch you with the team that understands their playbook.
Oh, I see.
Right? So they have a a very specific playbook, unlike a lot of PEs.
PEs, yeah.
They have a general playbook. No, they have a playbook of, we bring in this team, then this team, then this team, and then you execute against this plan, and this is how we work, and this is how. And so, you know, again, it's non-founder driven typically. I think generally speaking, not everyone, but generally speaking, much more common. Different animal.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, now that you've said that, I suppose some of the dynamics one sees in the marketplace begin to make sense. I'm curious about you. And when I was prepping for this conversation, one of the things that stuck out at me is that you're a son of two doctors.
Yeah.
What was that like? And how did parents feel when you were like, well, you know, I'm actually going to get into like this world of tech and do my own thing?
So they knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur when I was 11.
Right.
They thought I would outgrow it. They didn't know what I was going to do in a business, but they knew it. So, I mean, anyone that's known me was not surprised that I was going to start a business. They really? Were just surprised that I worked for one company before I started.
Who'd you work for?
LEK.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, it was a great experience. And actually, it helped me tremendously as an entrepreneur. But I think the longer you stay in consulting, the less entrepreneurial you become.
True story.
So if you don't leave early, you'll get trapped in a weird PowerPoint world instead of reality, and you'll forget how to manage people or whatever it is.
Yeah.
My parents had no idea what I was doing. So they said, "What? Just go to graduate school." I said, "That's kind of a waste of time." So I said, so maybe I'll get like a JD MBA, but I'll never use the JD. So I said, okay, I'll get a JD because you want me to, they prefer that I did medical research and cured cancer. But I said, okay, what if I become a JD MBA and never practice the law? I go, like, yeah, that'd be great. Just get an advanced degree. So I interviewed six JD MBAs at Harvard while I was there.
Wow.
In undergrad, and none of them were using the JD. Zero. And they said, don't do it. I was like, what? Look at all the JDMs. No one's using the JD. You get the training, but if you're really going to be an entrepreneur, which actually most people end up doing anyways, or you know, they're using the MBA side of their world, the JD was intellectually interesting, but somewhat irrelevant to the career path that they
take. It's crazy.
So I said, hey, mom, dad, I'll get an MPA, public policy, because I did a group negotiation theory in my undergrad. So I said, I'll go to the Kennedy School and get a double degree there. And they're like, oh, that sucks as a degree. We want you to get like a doctor or a lawyer degree because we're traditional Koreans.
Yes.
And I go, well, so I applied and accepted. And then I said, nah. After the first year, I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to finish the MBA. But I'm definitely going to. It's like, this internet thing is timing. You got to move fast. So I almost dropped out. And I was talking to a professor of mine. He goes, why would you drop out? Your second year, you can fashion every single class around your business and work on it intensely.
No one
will care. The first year, you can't do that. The second year, it's all elective. You can do whatever you want.
Sure.
So you don't have to drop out. You're going to get your MBA anyways.
Sure, sure.
So and I don't think you'll be further behind. So I said, okay. So that's what I did. You know, I got my MBA and then launched my company. And my parents thought, when are you going to be done with that video gaming thing? I was like, the internet is not video games. I was like, you're playing with computers. And I'm like, I'm not coding. It's this low-cost, ubiquitous infrastructure. And they're like, games.
That's so good.
It wasn't until Li and Fung, we raised $250 million a secondary in March of 2000. And my parents read it in the journal or something. And they went, is that game you're working on? And I'm like, it's a supply chain coordination company.
That's so good.
And they're like, oh, they wrote about you in a newspaper. And I was like, yes. I was like, maybe it'll get respectable. Even if you ask them today, what did I do? They go, we have no idea.
Crazy. You know, in business, we often confuse hard work with progress. I meet entrepreneurs every single day who are grinding 18 hours, yet their systems are broken. Their invoicing, a mess. The way they manage stock and inventory, a mess. Website, missing or outdated. And here's the truth. In business, you don't scale chaos. You scale systems. That's what I want to talk to you about today. I came across this really interesting software called Odoo, and I want you to check it out. It's not just another shiny app. It's not like a tech gimmick. But what it is, it's actually a way to build an operating system because it has a suite of tools designed for you to enable your business to grow. With Odoo, whether you're running accounting or inventory or sales, or you're looking to build an online store, you can do all of those things in a single place. One source of truth, one platform, one entrepreneur. So imagine a world where you're talking and looking at your invoices. You can go from your invoices to your accounting, from your accounting to your point of sales, and all of these systems are talking to each other, including your inventory. All of it happening from your website with a single platform. It's an absolute game changer. And here's the kicker. The first app that you choose on Odoo is free. Free hosting, free support, even a free domain, if that's the one that you go for a period of a year on which you can build your free website. I like this because there's just no more excuses. No more, I don't have the money, or I can't build a website. I hear these excuses in my comment section from you guys all the time. And I tell you, you get to keep the excuses that you're fighting for. Now I bring to you here a platform that you can actually use that's for builders, for founders, that can give you the confidence and the courage to scale your business. So what I've done is I've included a link in the description. Go hit the link, go and check out the platform. Tell them I sent you, because if you're serious about business, I promise you now, Odoo is serious about you. See you soon. So you were just like fashion straight off the bat, doing your thing, very different. And you were probably clear you wanted to set your own pathway. Like, so the John that I'm meeting now is kind of always been you. You're just the guy who's setting his own pathway.
Yeah. A little more gray hair, a little more experience, a little more war scars, but pretty much the same.
If you don't mind my saying, I mean, it's difficult to do that when you're a child of immigrant parents, right? Because they tend to have very high standards. Because of their own experiences.
Oh, yeah.
Setting your own pathways, not like, hey, mom, I'm just going to do this. And they go, oh, yeah, sure, do your thing. You've got to be very strong.
But it's, well, a lot of it is being Korean. I was just having a conversation with a new friend that I met here.
Right.
And he was saying, so tell me about Korean. I was like, well, we have a chip on our shoulder. He goes, and he's French. He goes, I don't understand that colloquialism. I was like, well, it means that we have a little chip that's here, and if you knock it down, that's a challenge. Mm. So if you say something, it's like you knock the chip out of the shoulder. It's like throwing the gauntlet down.
Ah, right.
Go, so what does that mean? It's like, if you say you can't do something, he goes, yes, I can.
So does the reverse work? You can do something? No, I can't.
No. Everyone thinks they can do everything.
I get it.
Right? And they get deeply, their pride gets offended when someone doubts them.
Right.
Right? And so I think as Korean entrepreneurs, you know, I looked at LegalZoom, we're the largest incorporator of businesses.
Yes,
so
yes,
I was doing some, looking at some data of, you know, if you're an immigrant, you're 300% more likely to start a business than someone born inside of the United States.
Wow.
From the vast majority of countries pooled. I think once you take out Mexico, which has great entrepreneurs, but there's so many people immigrating from Mexico that are in other jobs, that it's about 200% on average, about 300% through, call it, you look through the top 80 countries. Mm. And we define that as most likely to own shares in a small business born outside of the country. Mm. The number one were Persians.
Oh, wow.
Number two were Koreans.
Oh, wow.
And it was a 0.1% difference. So I tell my Persian friends, you edged us out.
0.1.
But we'll get you. but if you look at even the top 10, it's fascinating because a little bit from everywhere around the world, right? So you have Persians in the Middle East. You've got the Dominican Republic is up there. Canada is up there. Vietnam is up there. So it's like from every part of the world, there's a section. But you have to, it's a very interesting lens to view entrepreneurship because it's the people that left that country. Mm. And that's different than the people that are in that country.
Yeah, it's very different.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but when I looked at the commonality between Persians and Koreans is I don't want to work for anyone, including my family. In particular, especially my family. Right? So that kind of creates its own entrepreneurial gene.
Right.
Right? Now, you know, so you see like these Persian families were like, well, all of us do real estate, but we all have our own companies.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and then we might collaborate on stuff, but we own our own things.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and I see so many, like even Korean entrepreneurs that are trying to pass on their business to their kids. The kid's like, oh no.
I'll do my own thing.
I was like, in your generation, what you did was cool. Mm. And I appreciate what that's been able to give to us in our lives.
Yeah.
But not for me.
Pithy. Watch what I'm going to do, Dad.
Yeah. I was like, you know, very few entrepreneurs clear $100 million self-made like your dad. I Amen. Wouldn't just poo-poo his company like that. <You know? laughs> But they're like, you haven't seen me. I was like, you're 18.
In their minds, they're going to be clearing that at like 25 or something. You know, it's like
they're like, you know, I'll be retired in 10 years. I was like, maybe. Maybe not.
as a father, do you think we're breeding a very how do I place this? Do you not think we're doing a very dangerous job of selling this message of abundance into this like generation that we're raising as parents? Because if you look at just the headlines, right, there's so much to go around. There is the abundance in capital, abundance in emerging technologies and resources, abundance in consumerism. There's just abundance everywhere. And, you know, don't you fear that sometimes we're just breeding a generation that doesn't have the thick skin to weather through the difficult times when those difficult times do come?
I don't see abundance everywhere.
Explain that to me. In your world especially, there's abundance everywhere, John.
Well, in my world, yes.
Sure.
In technology, but I also see things like AI radically reshaping the job markets, fundamentally reshaping in a negative way many professions, taking out 80, 90% of the jobs of certain professions.
Sure.
And so, and even like AI is dangerous for coders because we need fewer of them because now you can code with natural language. Mm. And so that's gonna, the whole nature of coding in 5 years will be it's already completely different today than it was 10 years ago. Mm. But 5 years from now, it'll be something that we don't even recognize.
Yeah.
So I'd say you live in incredibly fast changing times and you're gonna have to make it on your own. So I don't give them a path towards my abundance. Mm. I give them training and preparation and mentorship to figure out their own path.
I'm with you.
But I warn them that it was easier in your dad's generation to be an entrepreneur and to go after it. Mm. Because this world, you know, your chart, you were saying, hey, all of a sudden everything's linear and then it turns geometric.
Yeah. Yeah.
The human brain is not very good with geometric.
Explain that.
We think in a linear fashion. So if someone says, well, if computing power doubles every year, and you say, well, what will it be like in 20 years? People think, well, it'll just be steeper. No, no, it's not steeper. It's a different animal.
I'm with you. I completely
understand.
And so
we can't comprehend geometric progression in something like assets compounding. Mm. Difficult for people to, they can do the math, but it's difficult for people to grok. Mm. And when I say geometric computing power applied to AI with different kinds of functionality, it starts to explode at a pace that you can no longer
comprehend,
get your arms around.
I'm with you.
And I think that's frightening because more and more changes are geometric and we're radically underestimating the impact on the world. Mm. So I see a world where it's dangerous. The wealth concentration is very dangerous. Civility, what we call society, between the haves and have-nots, the growing disparity. Now, I think the far left in California got were smoking too much of whatever they were smoking and went too far left.
Yeah.
But this fundamental, because there's no, you know, I talked about in my speech, it's not like the system is rigged against them, et cetera. It's just people with assets that grow geometrically that are spending a tiny portion of their net worth are going to compound and you can never catch up.
You've got to run me through that, because yesterday when you mentioned it, I hadn't thought about it until you mentioned it. Then I started running the math in my head and I went, hold on, holy shit, right? And it's almost as if the rate at which those assets compound, you can't catch up.
Yeah, and this is how, so I look at it this way. People think, okay, what's, being from the U.S., it'll be American-centric, what's this American dream of retirement?
Yes.
The average American believes they need about $1.5 million to retire comfortably.
Right.
The average American saves 8% in the long term. Lately, they've been saving much less, but 8% in the long term. So let's say you make easy numbers, $100,000 per year.
Saving $8,000.
Decent income. Mm. Mm. You're saving 8%, the long-term average, mm. and you work for 30 years. Mm. And you make a 10% average annual return, mm. $1.3 million in your retirement. Mm. That's about roughly 3% of Americans end up with that in retirement, and 97% don't.
Whoa.
Today.
We're the 97%, below that.
Below that. And the 3% that do usually are making a lot more than that in that 1.3 million. So, but let's say 30 years, 1.3 million. Now, and the other example you put is like, let's say someone has an exit, their family office, they have a trust fund, whatever it may be, they have $20 million. It's a lot of money. And let's say they're not spending $92,000, let's say they're spending $1 million per year. Okay, 20 million, they make 10%, 2 million, they spend a million of it, 1 million goes back, now they got 21 million.
Yeah.
You expand that for 30 years.
Yeah.
Aggregates to about 100 and I think 184 million, 183, 184 million.
Sure.
Which is 140x.
Sure.
The person I was saying. So I was like, you can't catch up to
There's
this
no
person.
Way you're catching up. Yeah, yeah.
And that's where I think family offices are going to be more and more important. Because the family office size are going to grow geometrically. Mm. And so when you look at what happens over 20 or 30 years, people say, well, why does the top 10% own so much more of the country? I was like, they can't help it.
There is nothing else.
They're on a geometric,
I understand.
And you're saving 8% to put into a tiny portion, feeding it, but they started so much further and they're compounding, and they're also getting better returns mm. than you are because they've got exposure to different asset classes yeah. with certain minimums.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I look at that and I go, well, you can't catch up. So what does that mean? The richer will always get richer. The poor aren't necessarily getting poorer, but if they say compared to them, if I compare myself to Bezos, yeah. I get poorer every second.
Sure.
Right? His lead keeps growing on me.
That's a depressing thought.
Right? He's getting a multiple of my net worth every week. You know, my lifetime earnings. So I said, that's what I mean by it, other than creating wealth through equity, through creating companies and doing things that are dramatic, you can never catch up.
Wow.
And if I take a look at that as classes of entrepreneurs and then the generation of folks that may or may not inherit that depending on your estate planning, there's a world where when 100 million Americans, let's say, feel completely cheated and disenfranchised by a system that's not taking care of them, and they see this, and they've been seeing this for 10, 20 years, but the level of excess is growing and the disparity is growing. Hmm. If we're not taking care of the opportunities to that generation, so they feel like, I had a chance. Hmm. I had an education. I had assets. I had a chance to be a homeowner. I had a chance at a good life. But it feels like they're locked out. That's where you get civil unrest.
Absolutely.
That's where you get extreme radical behavior.
Absolutely.
And I think America's heading towards a path over the next 20 or 30 years that's front and center in that collide.
So there's a lot of macro themes there, right? Because I love the way you said, well, the wealthy can't help it. It's in the nature of capital to accumulate. I have this conversation often with friends of mine who are sometimes socialist leaning. And I say to them, you do understand that the nature of capital is accumulation. In fact, it's embedded in the characteristic of capital.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be capitalism, but anything that is capital will seek accumulation, right?
Yep.
But so you, on the one end, you say that, and then on the other, you go, we also have to make sure that we're creating a society that creates opportunities for people so they feel like they have a shot at it. Right in the middle is this conversation about artificial intelligence, which we both agree, on a balance of probabilities, is not likely to make the statement true that people feel like they have a shot. What it's actually going to do is it's going to take opportunities away from people rather than immediately bring opportunities to people's tables. So how do you sleep at night knowing and understanding this? Because these are very serious macro themes.
You know, I think I was fortunate to have been an entrepreneur in the time that I was.
Okay.
And it's still, I'm still an entrepreneur and it's still very exciting, but the internet, you know, there's, you know, web 1.0 and then there was cloud computing and then you get to crypto and now you're going to AI and there's waves of change that fundamentally reshape the world, but nowhere, never as quickly as you think, but then way quicker in hindsight than you would have expected.
Sure, sure. Fair point.
But we're starting to get wave after wave. The time frame you have to adjust to wave gets shorter, and shorter.
Yeah.
Right? So it's getting to the point where it's harder to extrapolate. I'm a pattern recognition guy. The patterns are getting more difficult.
Huh.
The pace of change is getting, and the just the dramatic nature of change is, it used to be stories and the reality was always slower. And now there's stories and the reality is getting faster.
Huh.
So I was like, ooh, this is getting a little sci-fi fantasy right now.
Holy shit. What did you just say? It used to be stories and then the reality was slower.
Yeah, people say, oh, the internet's going to change everything in 5 years. So I was like, no, it'll change things in like 10 or 12 years.
I'm with you.
Right? And people, everyone's talking about autonomous driving. It'll be here in 2 years, 3 years. I was like, maybe 10 or 15 years.
Sure.
And it's right on the cusp, but it's still not close.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
It's close. You got Waymo. You got Waymo. Things are going. Yeah, so you're a few years off. They just got to figure out the insurance thing. And, you know, we're right there. But when you think of like autonomous driving and delivery, the entire food industry is going to be upheaved.
Yeah.
Right? So if I can get motorcycles, autonomous motorcycles for $6,000 that have a cold and a hot and can deliver it, you know, somewhere in that.
Mm.
Now,
and that's downstream, right? That's before you do industrial scale Amazon moving things from kind of one workshop to another, and all of a sudden that's autonomous.
Right. They're doing it, and then you're not using drones, you're just using motorcycles that can drive themselves, right? With heating compartments.
Mm.
And, you know, Korea. Does it when the incremental cost of delivery is the same as being in the restaurant, whereas in the US it's 2x.
Hmm.
So, you know, all of these changes are going to transform the industry. And like, you know, Travis over at Ghost Kitchen's got a thesis around that is fascinating to me. And between autonomous driving and ghost kitchens and platforms and commissaries and individual concepts, there's going to be a lot of upheaval in an industry that's pretty crappy. Restaurants are a very difficult industry.
Yeah, quickest way to lose money for sure.
Yeah, and you look at call centers and I don't understand in the next 3 years how there can be anything but a 70-80% reduction in call center work. I mean, I work with an AI company, Realbotics, and they're doing really sophisticated AI customer care that operates already as the top 1% of customer care agents at a fraction of the cost.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the companies we implemented it just eliminated the entire division. And now they're getting top 1 percentile performance at 30% of the cost structure. And I was like, you could do that to 3,000-4,000 jobs just as easily as, you know, these 2 dozen jobs.
Mm.
And the functionality is there. So I was like, wow. What are all these people going to do? What are you going to do when there's no Uber drivers, when there's no call centers, right? And I take 12 million jobs out of the system. That's happening fast.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. So what do you do when 11 labs is at scale and suddenly you don't need, you know, the creative professionals to shoot ads and to do, you know, you can deploy to your point at scale with just a script and selecting a voice.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's scary, John.
What's scary is when you take all these jobs out, what are people going to do?
But this was going to be my question to you, because if I follow your life and your trajectory, I know we're jumping around a little bit, so I apologize for not following a chronology, but kind of when you started, right, you were at a time when it was pretty clear that there was an emergent technology, there was a societal use case, and there was an opportunity to disrupt existing industries by creating value addition. And you could make that point. Now, you've got an emerging technology, right? You've got a use case. You've got disrupted industries to be disrupted, but not necessarily the absorption from society anymore. That's a big game changer, right? Yeah. And yeah. So a lot of the skill sets required when you guys were starting, it's like very different now, surely.
It is very different, but I think being an entrepreneur is the same. I think the challenge is like you're still surfing, but the waves are rougher. They're larger. Mm. They're coming faster with less time to react between sets of waves.
Right.
Right. And you better be on a different kind of surfboard then. You know, so
for the benefit of the viewers watching this, you know, this podcast talks to entrepreneurs who are at that growth stage where they're trying to figure out how to do next. They've laid out the foundation. The foundation is solid, but it's like, how do I take my skill set to next? You're one of the very few people who's actually done that. If I look at the work that you did, that you and your team did with LegalZoom, look at the work you're doing now in the FO space, and I'm just like, you actually did that. So talk to us a little bit through that journey, like early days, what were the challenges, and then how did you go, this is what the use case is going to be, and then scale that?
I think it's like fishing. Who finds the best fishing spots, right? Because that's where the best opportunity, like here's a river of opportunity. I got to find my place in that river opportunity to cast.
Nice.
And take my piece out.
Nice,
right?
Nice.
How do you find the best place? Well, first you better start fishing. You better not read about it. You better not, you know, get a drone and look around. You know what you do? You start fishing. Hmm. And then you go, seems the fish like the slower current off on the sides.
Right.
Maybe that's where I should go.
Right.
And so by getting in the mix, you're best able to position yourself in the river.
Love it.
By taking more. So you got to get your hands dirty and jump in.
Yeah.
And then you actually have to pull back and say, well, did I probably didn't jump in opportunity spot number one, but if I keep moving, I'm probably going to come across.
Yeah.
And also, I don't need to go into the number one place across this 120 miles. Mm. I just need to catch my fish.
Mm.
So you're like, I'll get to a place where it's good. And then I got to say, the enemy of great is good enough.
Mm.
So do you keep moving? Are you still hungry? Mm. Do you try to go to that next thing?
Mm.
Right? Mm. And so I think some people stop early. And they said, I need 3 fish for my family. Mm. I'm coming back and I'll leave the fish for later because I'm only going to take as much as I need because society's better that way.
Sure.
Get it? Other people are like, I'm going to sell some fish in the market. I want as much as I can get. Right?
I need a fish truck.
So I think from my perspective, I was more interested in the process of catching fish. So I was like, how do I catch bigger fish? How do I catch up faster? How do I move along this river? Now, what's this river like? I'm trying to understand the principles of this river.
It's good.
Right?
It's like, so good.
So is it, do they like light? The fish like light? Does it like dark? Do they like fast water, deep water, slow water?
It's good.
And then let me see if I can predict where the next opportunity is going to be. Let me go there and test. That didn't work. That was a nice theory. It didn't work. Let me try this one. Mm. So I'm always thinking about that process in more of a, kind of a little bit more meta river. and I think that's what keeps me intellectually interested. And I tend to keep seeing things. There's a big opportunity there. There's a big opportunity there. And so I think it's just being curious and hungry. And that keeps you going. And it's also to this, like we talked a little bit earlier, I'll skip back to when we talked about like founder, non-founder friendly at early to late stage. A lot of that has to do with certain theories of leadership that are taught at business schools and in organizational behavior. And one model of leadership that really pissed me off when I was in school was, I said, okay, there's a leader, there's a startup leader, there's a growth leader, there's a steward of the brand capital, there's a turnaround guy like Chainsaw Al. And there's these 4 models. And typically, you're good at one of these models and you're not good at any of the other.
Yeah, that's what the theory says.
Right. And so one of the teachers said, so you got to figure out where you're going to play along this.
Right.
I go, hold on. I'm going to start my company. And you're saying, if I take it to 100 million, I can't take it to a billion. Yeah. If I get to 10 million, I can't take it to 100 million. So I was like, you're going to let me raise my baby and then you're going to take it away from me?
Exactly.
I was like, I find that deeply offensive.
That's the Korean chip again.
Yeah, my chip comes out. So I go, hey. I was like, but then we have examples of entrepreneurs that have kept it going all the way. He goes, no, This is the theory. That's the 80. 20% of people can move between them. It may not be best for them, but they have the capacity to move. Now, and then what I found in reality, startup guys that love startups, that's they don't like the steward. It's too slow. It's big and slow. So they like going back because they like the rush.
Yes.
They like the creation process.
Yes.
Right? They like, it's like an architect. I like to design the house. I don't want to build it.
Yes, yes.
I don't want to do the plumbing.
Yes, yes, yes. I understand.
Right? I want to design it.
Sure, sure.
That to me is the creative exercise.
Sure.
So, and other people are like, well, I like to get my hands dirty.
100%.
I want to build this.
Yes, yes. I'm a maintenance guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to construct it with my hands.
Yes.
I want concept to be reality. Reality is more important to me than the concept.
Concept, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You do your little AI picture. I have the real thing. This is what I appreciate, right? So I found, fascinating. Usually people love what they're good at. And so they say, okay, I'm passionate about this. I'm going to stay. Mm. I'm a steward. Fine. Mm. I'll take a public. And it's weird because people have egos about it. Mm. Like I was talking to one public company CEO. He goes, I love what you guys do in building. I could never do that. And I'm like, the tone, and I didn't know this person that well, felt patronizing. I was like, no, because your job is to take over, right? As a steward, you're hired in, right? You're taking over an existing public company. You're popping in. You're like, no, I respect the founding process, but I can never do it myself. And what you're also saying is they couldn't do what you do.
100%.
Right? That's the subtext.
That's the, I was about to say.
And by the way, some people can't, nor do they want to, but other people can. So it was saying it as if I can't do what you do, but you can't do what I do.
Yes.
And
yes.
Mine is, I like my risk reward profile better than yours.
Yes. Yes.
Type of thing. So I was like, hey, don't take it all personal. Get your egos out of this. Mm. What do you love to do? What makes you happy? Go do it. Mm. Go do it. Mm. If you're mission driven and you want to see that mission accomplished, you want to stay with that company and stay with the mission. Mm. Right? Mm. So there are things more important than I'm good at a certain skill set, so therefore I should transition when my skill set's no longer valuable. Mm. That's not the way entrepreneurs think, per se.
Yeah.
So I think that's just one of the things that it's important to be cognizant as you shift gears from startup to growth to maintaining a larger company. How do you as a leader need to change your behavior? You can't do it by doing the same thing you did.
In the early days, did you have a sense of how big the market was going to be? How big the internet was going to be?
Yes.
What was it in your mind that you downloaded to help you understand that?
What you could do as a business, the way you could communicate instantly, the way you could break these predetermined channels of communication. Like someone said something a long time ago about like the Cosby Show at one point would have like, 40% of adult Americans tuned in on a whatever night it was showing.
Wow.
Right? And that's before content fragmentation from cable.
It's crazy.
Right? So the powers that be in media could force feed, right, society, almost like propaganda.
Exactly.
Like, boom, here's the model of the American family. Here's our version of comedy. Here's our version of this. And then
they did the same thing with music too, right?
Right, and now all of a sudden, with content proliferation and micro niches, now there's a creative explosion and now you can't control it. So when I looked at, again, where the internet was going with, we're going to get faster, the infrastructure will take time to develop, but we'll have a low-cost infrastructure that will be ubiquitous, that can move text, images, and video instantaneously at high fidelity. What does that mean for commerce? What does that mean for content and consumption, and how will they interact? And I was like, wow, this will be pretty transformative. Because the world of not having it is boring, inefficient, and relies on imperfect information and asymmetry of information
100%.
In order to make your margin.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So you go, well, if I have perfect information, all this crappy business is going to disappear.
That's right. That's right.
And it's like, and what I liked about the internet is usually it's winner take all.
That's right.
Like after eBay, who's number two? They suck.
Huh.
Right? Huh. After Amazon.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
So there's not a lot of room for number two.
Yeah.
The internet doesn't like that.
Yeah.
They're like one. Like five people try to be one, one is one, and two is 10. Doesn't matter.
It's like we all know Medallion, and then nobody else. Yeah, I got you.
So
I got you.
The Korean competitive chip guy goes, good to be one there. Let me go to an industry where one's very valuable.
That's so good.
Right? And so that to me is the fun part of it. Right? And so that's why when I thought, wow, when winner takes all for a market as large as the US, and then the internet is going to be global. Now one US becomes one global.
That's right.
If you can manage all the politics and the regulation and privacy and all the other things that will come up.
Yeah.
But I was like, wow. So what we think of as a global conglomerate today, which is based on amassing capital that can be deployed, those that can raise capital in the capital markets, then deploy them in other markets without such capital and have a competitive advantage, which is just brute force.
So good.
Now the internet, I built a better mousetrap in a big market. I'll take your small market. I'll take your other big market.
That's right.
Right? And so you're like, ooh, this gets really interesting. Mm. I think the new titans of industry will all be in tech. Because they're going to go global in a way that other people can't. And their competitive advantage transfers in a way that won't. So now the stakes are much bigger. You're not playing for the US. You're playing for the world.
Huh.
So that I was like, oh, this is a much better place to be an entrepreneur. Because your success gets amplified. Not everyone goes global, but the fact that you can, the fact you can take it to a different level is far more interesting. And if you like to travel and you like to speak different languages and you like communicating with different cultures, it's a pretty rewarding thing when you start expanding internationally. It's fun. So I think that's what attracted me, is just, you could just kind of extrapolate, ooh, this world is going to be different. It's going to be a fun place to be. It'll be a pain in the ass, but wow, you could spend 10, 20, 30 years and not get bored.
So you guys build a business, you exit. Of all of the things you could have done, how do you find yourself now being on the other end, deploying capital, now in the FO space, managing a family office? Like, I suppose the question I'm asking is, why didn't you go back for second dibs and go, we're going to do this again?
My kids didn't want me to.
Oh, wow.
So I asked my kids.
You asked your kids?
Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with my kids.
Right.
I got three boys.
Right.
And so I asked them, Daddy's exiting LegalZoom. He's got a few ideas to start up a new company. Mm. You want Dad to take some time off? They said yes. And they were very strong about it. They said, we're only kids for so long. Mm. We like spending a lot of time. Mm. They don't remember that I used to spend 1 or 2 days a week in a different city or a different country every week.
Mm.
They don't remember that. All they remember now is since COVID, they're like, Dad's here all the time. My son's like, going out to dinner again? I was like, it's been 3 weeks since I've gone out to dinner. What do you mean again? You're getting way too used to Dad being home. So I was like, and then COVID hit shortly. Mm-hmm. And so I was spending a ton of time with children and it was great. And I was like, okay, during this craziness, let's go to Korea. Let's escape this lockdown. Let's give you an international experience. Let's go. Had a great time with it. Started investing, but would be more of a board member, active, executive director. So that was a good place to be during this whole COVID craziness, and it was great for my kids. And so when we moved back to Los Angeles in June, after 5 years of bouncing around in different places, I asked my kids, Dad's getting a little itchy. About ready. Then my 14-year-old, my 12-year-old said, now it's more important that you're home.
Oh, wow.
We got 4 years left, and then I'm off to college. Isn't this the time where you should be teaching us? Spend time with us.
Wow, John.
And I'm like, you're going to make me feel really guilty doing something new.
Did they win the debate?
For now. I said, there's a balance between me being a father and me being a human being.
Amen.
And so there's certain things that I do love what I'm doing now, but I do itch for more.
Mm.
And I'll find the correct balance. It moves around.
Mm.
So I was like, listen, it's not as crystal clear and black and white.
Mm.
I can be an investor. I can be an operator.
Mm.
Right? And in some ways, I could spend 20% or 30% of my time in one company.
Mm.
And that's okay. Mm. And I could spend 0% of my time in another company.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's fine. But now I can choose what's interesting, what's the best use of time, who needs me to be more active.
When we started chatting earlier, you made the point about how you think family offices is going to be perhaps the most influential force in private capital in the next couple of decades. Run me through your thesis on this.
So I see the concentration of wealth in a wider and wider group.
Sure.
So when you look at folks that have exited now and they've got a $10 million or a $20 million or a $50 million exit, and you know, of course, there's people with, you know, up and down the spectrum. Mm. There's a lot of people that there's been a lot of wealth creation. Mm. And those family offices are nascent. They're new. They haven't dealt with generational planning, but they're going to learn fast. They're going to learn the lessons from folks beyond. And there's a lot of it. They're starting now to, and there's always been consortiums, but they're getting more formal, more powerful, and competing in different ways. Mm. So it used to be those family offices would take a percent and say, oh, I'll put some in alternatives and I'll be an LP here. And you know, so I'm a hedge fund and I go, okay, I got my endowments, I got my pension funds, I got my family offices, and I'll take a piece. Then increasingly they're like, but that family office isn't on a deal with me. And that family office isn't on a deal with me.
Sure.
So it's starting to happen.
Sure.
They're writing larger and larger checks. And then you get the mega family offices, of which I just met one earlier today that kind of shocked me.
What is a mega family office?
And they're folks that can write $500 million checks.
On a single ticket?
Well, do you think of Bezos's family office. When you've got $150 billion of assets, $500 million ain't all that much.
That's a fair point.
Right?
It's a fair point.
You know, if he's making $15 billion on his 10% return, you know, and Amazon's growing more than 10%, right? You're getting these incredible assets.
So
when you look at, again, there's the wealthiest tech entrepreneurs, and they're largely tech entrepreneurs that have been doing this. Mm. And Field's been doing it across many industries, but when I see about wild generational wealth, folks at Alibaba, whether it's Jack Ma or Joe Tsai, or you look at what Jensen's going to eventually do it at NVIDIA. I'm not sure. I don't know him, so I don't know what he's up to. Or, you know, people are starting to write checks that are very large and competing with other types of private equity type investments.
It's crazy.
And more and more people are doing that.
That's a game
more
changer.
People are coming together.
Yeah.
In a way that funds are kind of doing what funds have been doing. But that playbook is pretty straightforward, and a lot of people are doing it. And they, you know,
tinkering
one partner
at the edges.
Goes off and does it, and then has a good relationship.
They
schism, but it's kind of boring.
Yeah.
They're doing their thing.
Yeah.
But still, relative to 15 years ago, there's the same two dozen folks. Now two or three family offices have come into it, or two or three country funds have come into it. Mm. So country funds and family offices, I see, are the things that are starting to move.
Crazy.
And now this incremental value you have to take your 1% in management fees and your 20% in carry.
In carry, yeah.
More and more people, I could do that myself.
100%. Now I don't have fees and I don't have the carry.
So,
and I'm getting into the same transaction with the same risk profile.
Mm-hmm. I can give people that, but then increasingly if that becomes interesting, if I want to save on the fee structure, the carry, if I think I can add similar kinds of value, and by being an LP, I'm learning, which a lot of family offices are doing, and then they're going direct after that learning period. Mm. So I'm curious what that's going to do over time, but my exposure to some of the family offices, they're pretty bright folks, and the second generation coming in want to make their own mark. Mm. They don't want to be passive investors allocating capital. Mm. Mm. So I was like, if they want to make their own mark, they're going to go direct. Mm. And they may be going direct at larger check sizes than you think. Mm. Now they're doing, going direct might be a $10 million or $20 million check, which is still big for family office. Mm. But that second generation wealth might want to start writing $50 or $100 million. Well, all of a sudden now they're going right up against the big guys. It'll be interesting to see. But you know, that's what I see as the extrapolation of what's happening today.
Before I let you go, we call this podcast Ideas That Matter. You know, we're at over a couple of tens of millions of downloads, 1-point-something million subs on YouTube. I only mentioned the macro numbers so that you understand the weight of the question I'm going to ask you next, which is the last question. Sure. The reason we call it Ideas That Matter is because my theory is that every single person has a single idea they hold to be so true that it drives them no matter what's happening in the world or what's happening in their lives. If I were to ask you, what is that idea? Apart from the Korean chip of the shoulder, what's the single idea you hold to be so true that you think you can bend the universe to believe it?
You know, someone asked me this in a previous interview, like, what's your one saying? I don't have one.
Really?
I am Christian.
Right.
So there are many things that come to mind, but not one.
Sure.
I think for me, what drives me is to live an interesting life. Amen. And a fulfilling life.
Amen.
Based on the values that I grew up with and the values that I hold dear. And they're different than other people's values. So I care about things that other people don't care about. And that's cool. You don't have to care about the thing. But when I want to spend my life working in something, it needs to reflect my passion, my interest, my values, so I'm fully engaged and feel alive. So for me, it's more about keeping the curiosity alive and then executing against it and feeding it and growing it. But I don't really have an end game. I don't have an end goal other than on my bucket list, I want a piece of the Lakers. That's my thing. That's
hey, as long as I get courtside.
That's what motivates me.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's my good friend, John Sue, I'd like to call him. He's my good friend now, who soon is going to have a piece of the Lakers. Thank him so much for joining our Ideas That Matter podcast. Down below, we'll share all of John's details that you can go and follow him on all the different socials. John, I think you're capital raising at the moment, right?
For some of the companies that I've invested in are capital raising,
right,
yes.
Right,
yes,
so he's, for those of you who watch this who are institutional investors, he's in the capital markets as well. We'll make sure that we give you all of his details. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
We're going to let him go because he's got a startup competition for which I have now made him 10 minutes late, and I profusely apologize. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Share with us comments below about what you thought were the insights and nuggets that came out of it for you. Cheers.